Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, is what we call home in the Fukushima South Pacific sun that shines like plutonium particles on the beach. My very special guest today is David Stein. David, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's a true pleasure to be here. And, you know, people sometimes get confused about what to call me because I was born David Cole and I did all of my work as a Holocaust revisionist as David Cole. Then I became David Stein in 1997. And I was David Stein up until exactly, practically almost a year ago, April 19th. 2013. And then I became... Cole again, somewhat reluctantly, but these days people can call me whatever they want to. David Stein, David Cole, David Colstein, David Stein Cole. I'm open to any of those names.
You know, here's a good idea. You should change it to a Jewish name so that people wouldn't attack you quite as much and you could call yourself Coldstein.
Well, one of the things that my friends who knew me as Cole, one of the things they thought was funny was that I changed it from Cole to Stein, because normally the pattern among Jewish Americans is to make the name less Jewish. Like, for example, an actress like Natalie Portman, whose real last name is Hirschlag, which is really not a marquee name. I'm going to go see that wonderful new Natalie Hirschlag movie. Hirschlag almost sounds like an insult. It's like, wow, check out that girl over there. Man, what a Hirschlag.
Sounds like a bad internet connection. You know, there's a lot of Hirschlag on this line.
So usually that's the pattern, is they change it to a less Jewish name. I was born David Cole, and that is my real last name. But I did decide to start going under Stein after the Jewish Defense League tried to kill me on a couple of occasions. That the Jewish Defense League, for your listeners, was a very violent, somewhat murderous group of Jewish vigilantes and thugs in Southern California. And I wanted to blend in with a name that would be really, really ordinary, very common. I was already David, and then you add Stein to it. My gosh, there are so many David Steins in the United States. You couldn't have found me if you tried. It was a very purposely ordinary name that I chose.
Like, it would be a good one to have a TV show, like you could have a Stein time slot or something like that. You know? Stein time with David Stein.
There were so many people over the course of 17 years who got to know me as David Stein. It was most of them still call me that. And I'm not even really sure what to call myself. You live under a name for 17 years. That's a long time in the average human lifespan, and it's quite a long time to go under a certain name. My ID was always David Cole, and that would pose the occasional problem when I would do my political organizing, because it's part of what I got into around 2008. I worked with the Republican Party in California, and when I would do my partying events, and I would have to leave my credit card at the bar to start a tab. And a lot of times, as I'm sure you know, I'm not trying to indulge in the stereotype of Aussies and New Zealanders as drinkers, but I'm sure you know that the bar is loud and sometimes you got to call out the name that's on your tab. And that would always pose a problem for me if I had to call out David Cole, because there'd be people around me who wouldn't know what the hell I was talking about. So I would always try to, like, bring the barmaid in very close and be like, oh, I don't want other people to hear the name on my tab because they might swipe it. So just between us, it's David Cole. And I would try to get away with it that way.
Well, let's actually talk about this then. Just tell us a little bit about who you actually are and what you do.
Well, starting in 1989, I got involved in the Holocaust revisionism field. I was the only Jewish guy fully into it. There had been Jewish people, both in the United States and Europe, who had flirted with it in one way or another, but there had never been a full-blooded Jewish Holocaust revisionist, someone who believed that the history of the Holocaust, as we had been taught since the end of the war, needed major, major revising. So I got into it in 89, and by 91, I was doing many major talk shows in North America. I toured Europe. I toured Japan, toured Canada with historians like David Irving. I testified at trials and basically got myself in a whole lot of trouble. I had always believed that if I could simply get the opportunity to explain myself well and explain my views, that people, even if they didn't agree with me, would at least respect that I wasn't a monster.
Big mistake.
I'm not the kind of person who wants people to necessarily agree with me, because I understand the diversity of human opinion. There's a difference between saying you must agree with me and saying, look, go ahead and disagree with me, but don't try to kill me. But I began to accrue a lot of death threats, a lot of just general nastiness. In fact, I am on record, not from me pushing this, but from internet experts writing about it, I'm on record as being the first person who was subjected to internet death threats, like right when the internet started up as a popular thing in the early 90s. I was the first person who was marked for death on the internet, according to internet experts.
Did it make you feel special?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, I always feel special, but not necessarily in the good way. But yeah, I certainly felt privileged, but I dealt with it. I got beat up three times, not once in 91 and twice in 94. And I dealt with it. That never scared me away, because the way I look at my own face, punching it around can only improve it. Justin Bieber, where a couple of blows to the noggin is going to make me look like the Elephant Man. It's just going to make me look better the more I get punched. So I never minded that until at the end of 97, this Jewish Defense League group that had been behind several of the beatings, they just straight out put a $25,000 bounty on my head for my death. And as sad as this is to say, I knew my friends, and I knew that one of them was going to cash in on that. My friends, wonderful people at the time, but very much in need of money, and the lure of 25 grand, I knew someone would give in to it. So I gave in. I ended up being the one to give in January of 98. I surrendered to the Jewish Defense League, and I told them I would leave the field forever. That's when I became David Stein and started working in the legitimate film industry, and eventually by 2008 segued into working into legitimate United States politics.
Did you ever find the irony of being a Jew getting beaten up because people are afraid that you'll offend Jews?
Oh gosh, yeah. You can't not see the humor in that when there are groups whose entire reason for being is we're here to protect the Jews, and they're doing that by beating the living crap out of you as a Jew. The irony was very strong and ever present, but I knew that I was stepping into a landmine. I don't denounce anything I said in my youth, 89 through 97, the things I wrote, the things I said, the interviews I did. That's what everybody wanted to know when I was outed a year ago. They wanted to know, well, do you still stand by what you said? And I could only be honest at that point and say, yeah, I do. I'm not insane, and I'm my opinions back then, as young as I was, my opinions back then were well thought out, and I'm always open to the idea that I'm wrong. But since no one ever wants to prove me wrong, all they want to do is pound me in the face, it's very difficult to be convinced you're wrong when people are not reasoning with you but just stomping on you. That's not the best way to make an argument, is to kick someone in the face. Really bad.
It is if you want them to stop arguing all of a sudden.
Yeah. Well, you're right, Vinny, because it certainly worked in my case. I definitely did. I backed off and stayed behind the scenes for many, many years. In fact, I never planned to come back. When I was outed a year ago, it was completely without my consent, although I knew it was coming for a couple months and I was bracing for it. But it was not something I wanted. I didn't necessarily want to be back here, but I am. And you deal with the hand that you are dealt, you try to make the best of it. So that's what I've been doing. That's why I wrote a book. And that's why I'm promoting a book, and I think it's a fairly decent book. But of course, that's not for me to say. But going back to a year ago, yeah, I knew it was coming, and I was not happy about it.
Now, are you that young guy who was like on TV or whatever, and the old lady from the audience got up and said that she saw Joseph Mengele or something like that when she was brought into the camp? Are you that guy?
Yes, that was one of the dozen or so shows I did. That particular show that you're referring to was the Phil Donahue show from January of 94, and I was there talking about showing footage of my work in Eastern Europe, studying the supposed gas chamber sites at Nazi concentration camps. And this woman who had been in one of the camps as a very young girl got up and began repeating the terrible propaganda about human soap being made, human soap, human lampshades. It was an uncomfortable moment, not so much for me, but for the fellow who was representing the other side of the debate. A friend of mine named Dr. Michael Shermer, who's very big in the skeptic atheist community, that's kind of his thing. And I had gotten Dr. Shermer on the show to debate me because no one else would. And he was a friend of mine, and he wanted to be on national TV real badly back in 94. And this was an incredibly uncomfortable moment for him, because here was a woman who was yelling at me about human soap, human lampshades, Dr. Mengele making soap. Now, everybody in the field of Holocaust history knows that the human soap story is pure propaganda from the British, primarily the Americans to a lesser extent, but primarily the British circulated that story both in World War I and World War II. It was just one of those pull it out of your butt propaganda stories that the British loved doing, bayoneting babies and making human soap.
It was like the Kim Kardashian of way back in the day. You know, it's just like, will this distract and brainwash people? Yeah, okay, let's pull out our ass. You know.
Yeah, exactly. It was, and it's because it's a ghastly idea that the enemy is taking the bodies of their slain and making soap out of it. Because, of course, fat has been used. The fat of living creatures has been used in soap. But the human soap propaganda has never been found to be true in any war. But it's something that the British pushed in both world wars. In fact, an interesting anecdote is that the British pushed that human fat into soap story. They pushed it so much that Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, in 1944, Himmler put out the word in his own office to make sure it wasn't true. He kept reading about it in the New York Times and the London Times so much that he was like, are we really doing this? Because Himmler had commissioned a brigade called the Dirlewanger Brigade, made up of criminals, SS men who were criminals, and Himmler wanted to see if they would fight more fiercely because they had been imprisoned and they were released in order to become their own brigade. But they were kind of crazy. The Dirlewanger Brigade was made up of a couple of kind of nutty people. So Himmler was afraid that this brigade made up of hardened criminals was actually doing this kind of stuff. So he sent the word out in his office to find out, are we doing this? Because if we are, we have to arrest those people. But it turned out they weren't. No one made human soap out of anyone during either World War One or World War II. No one bayoneted babies. There are stories. Just one other quick thing I'll bring up. There's a story from the Treblinka camp about how the Nazis would throw a Jewish person into a cage, and in this cage would be a bear and an eagle. And the eagle would eat the Jewish guy's eyes out, and then the bear would tear him open in the midsection. And I, the first time I heard that story, I thought, how the hell did they get the bear and the eagle to agree on the division of labor between the two of them? The eagle's like, I got the eyes. The bear's like, yeah, I got the rest of him. And why didn't the bear just eat the eagle? Because bears are a lot more likely to eat another animal, non-human animal, than a human. These things were popularized in newspapers and magazines during the war, and they were almost all debunked. A lot more has been debunked than hasn't been. There's really only a few major points that still need reworking, predominantly the gas chamber and the Auschwitz extermination camp story. But a lot has already been debunked. Even if some of these stories exist in popular imagination, most scholars have long ago given up on the human soap, the human lampshade. Dachau, which is one of the camps that the American army liberated, Dachau, they no longer claim people were gassed there, although they still show a gas chamber to tourists at the Dachau camp outside of Munich, which is just fascinating. When you think of it, that the claim is that the Nazis built a gas chamber at Dachau and then decided to never use it, and it gathered dust, and they never dismantled it, and they never got rid of it or blew it up as the Allies were approaching, and it's a story that makes no sense. It's actually just a shower room, purely a simple, ordinary shower room. Not that anything in a civilian internment camp is ordinary, because civilian internment camps, whether we're talking about Dachau or Auschwitz or anything, they're all horrible. They're all human rights nightmares. But it was the room at Dachau was just a shower room and nothing more than that.
So what we're talking about here, and in fact, I came up with a conclusion, and I actually really want your take on it specifically. I was like thinking to myself, okay, Think like a criminal scumbag who wants to take over the earth for a moment. All right, so if you were to finance Hitler, start a world war, and also have this Holocaust thing in the middle of it, what would be the point, and why is it still propagating? I thought for a moment that if I was a criminal bankster, what I'd do is I'd finance somebody, and then I would create a massive war machine, and that would provide justification for an even bigger war, so which I can finance both sides. And once I got all that money and what have you, then I need to eliminate all my competition. So who's the group of people with the largest quantity of disposable income that I can steal? Ah, people who can't own land, like Jews. And on top of that, let's say, what if it was a Jewish element, like, say, the Rothschild family or something of that nature, that financed this operation? What would be the justification there? Well, it means that anybody, anywhere, anytime in future who criticizes the state of Israel or human rights abuses or anything of that nature will be called an anti-Semite and refer to the Holocaust, so that where nobody can ever question them ever again. Brilliant.
Yeah, what we're talking about, Vinny, is a perfect storm of sorts. We're talking about a perfect storm in that, on the one hand, this propaganda was initially begun by the Soviets and the Western allies. And so you had the entire might of the Soviet Union and Joseph Stalin. And then you had the entire might of the Roosevelt administration and Churchill. And then on top of that, you have the Jewish community, which at the time, going back to the war years, at the time there was the very heavily Zionist element that was wanting to establish Israel in the Middle East. So they took that ball and ran with it. And then, even beyond that, you've got even more of a perfect storm, because you also have the fact that most of the East Coast Jewish opinion makers of the day were fairly secular. They were not Orthodox. They were not Hasidic. The Holocaust and that propaganda became a kind of religion for them. It went beyond merely being calculating to achieve an end. It went beyond being the means to get an end. What it ended up being was a surrogate religion, a surrogate faith. The people who have hit me the hardest, both in the early 90s and now in the past year after I was outed, the people who have hit me the hardest are atheist Jews or secular non-religious Jews. They come after me with a vengeance. I actually get a slightly more sympathetic ear from Hasidic or Orthodox Jewry, Jews who are more into the religious aspect of the faith. But for the atheist Jews, the ones who see it as a race and not a religion, well, you know, you can claim to be atheist all you want. Something's eventually going to creep in to supplant that need that a lot of human beings have for a religious faith. And for way too many Jews, the Holocaust, as it was defined after the war, has become that surrogate faith. And I get the most hatred from non-religious Jews. I mean, they pillory me constantly. And that was true in the early 90s, and it's just as true now.
Well, key bono, who benefits? Who benefits from this Holocaust thing?
It's taken on a life of its own. And of course, it benefits the state of Israel. But I really do want to be very clear that I'm a historian first and foremost. And as a historian, I see my job purely as sorting out the facts from the fiction, sorting out the things that are provable from the things that are purely circumstantial, from the things that are probably complete nonsense. There are people who have grasped upon the Holocaust story as it was codified after the war, and they've used it for political means in Israel and in the United States and in Europe. But it also goes on the other side. There are people who grasp revisionism, the kind of thing that I do, and they attempt to use it. They use Holocaust revisionism against Israel and against AIPAC and Israeli lobby groups. This is not a cop-out on my part, what I'm about to say, but I try to stay above that, above all sides. I'm not a political historian, and I honestly don't have an agenda. People have accused me of having an agenda for my entire professional life. My agenda is simply to be accurate about the facts. If it benefits one political group or one nationalist group, if it benefits Jews, right-wing Jews in Israel, if it benefits Palestinian activists, if it benefits anyone, that's not really my concern. I study the facts and I write honestly about what I say. Now that I've said that, absolutely, the propaganda and the falsehoods that have surrounded Holocaust history have been of tremendous use to the state of Israel and to North American and European Jewish organizations. It's used as a billy club a lot. And that's unfortunate because the state of Israel should be able to exist on its own account and not because of stories that can't be verified from 1942 and 1943. I'm simply saying that's just simply not my thing. My thing is I researched the facts. I traveled around the world, studied every archive that was possibly available to be studied, and interviewed survivors and perpetrators and people from every side of things. And I just present what I feel to be accurate. And all I ask of people is to, if they think I'm wrong, to debate me on the facts and not to call me a self-hating traitor or a Jew who has stabbed his own people in the back or whatever they want to call me. I just want to debate the facts because history has fascinated me. Vinny, it's what I love. It's what I love being part of, and it's what I love researching.
Yeah.
So,
well,
yeah.
And you can't make history up, you know. Well, yeah, you could try, right. and in many cases be successful, but you can't actually argue the facts if you ain't got any to back them up.
This is one of the reasons that the governments of Western Europe and Canada have criminalized Holocaust revisionism. Now, this is very, very unprecedented in the Western world. You can stand on a street corner in Berlin and you can say not a single Armenian was ever killed by the Turks during World War I. And you can stand on a street corner in France and you can say the great terror following the French Revolution is hokum. It never happened. It was nonsense. There were no guillotines. No one was ever guillotined. And people might say you're wrong, and indeed you would be wrong, but you're not going to get thrown in prison for being wrong. What the governments of Western Europe and Canada have done is criminalize one particular type of historical argument. That alone should tip people off that revisionists are onto something, because if we were truly full of nonsense, then why criminalize us? No one's ever had to criminalize saying that the earth is flat. Nobody has ever had to criminalize people who say that Bigfoot roams the Pacific Northwest in Oregon and Washington, or the Loch Ness Monster is a plesiosaur that rises from the depths of the loch and kills people. No one's ever had to criminalize that. So when you have this one thing, Holocaust revisionism, where people can be put in prison for years simply for speaking of it, the average common sense human being would probably say, well, that's just odd that this one thing has been chosen. Let me give your listeners a very quick example. Some of them may remember in the 90s that there was a very popular female tennis star named Monica Seles. She was one of the highest ranked of the female pro tennis players. And during one of her matches against Steffi Graf, who was German, it was, I believe at the time, it was the two highest ranked female tennis players going against each other in a match. During the match, a very mentally unstable German fellow who did not want Monica Seles to win because Monica Seles was of Serbian descent and Steffi Graf was German. So in order to get his way, this bystander, this audience member in the gallery, jumped down onto the court and stabbed Monica Seles in the back with a butcher knife, nearly killed her. He ended her tennis career for good. She never came back because of all of the torn tendons, muscles. It was a terribly damaging injury. Now, this fellow, this German fellow in Germany, who stabbed Monica Seles in the back trying to kill her, got about one-tenth of the sentence that you would get by being a Holocaust revisionist in Germany. In other words, you jump down onto a tennis court, you plunge a butcher knife repeatedly into a young woman meaning to kill her, and you end up disabling her but not killing her. And you get about one-tenth of the time in prison that you would get if you said, I don't think there were gas chambers in Auschwitz. Something is fundamentally wrong when a government punishes historians worse than it punishes someone who tries to murder an athlete because he doesn't like her nationality.
It's freaking insane. And in my opinion, like, I've been into conspiracy research for quite some time. The only time when anything's obviously a conspiracy is when there's a break from standard operating procedure, right? Standard operating procedure for historians is what? What do you do first? You look at the facts, you look at the evidence, then you verify those, then you let that lead your conclusion. These people seem to be offering up the exact opposite, which is they take a predestined conclusion first of all, and then attack anybody who questions their preconceived notions that they were brainwashed into believing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a corruption of the field of history. The field of history itself has been corrupted by this. And you know what, I think one of the things that bugs me the most is when I used to hear my foes, the people who would debate me on talk shows, the people who would write negative things about me, and they would say, David Cole must be wrong because nobody is coming to his defense. Well, if you're facing 8 years in prison for coming to my defense, a lot of people are not going to come to my defense. Let's begin by leveling the field and saying no one goes to prison, regardless of what they say about Auschwitz. And let's start there. And then let's see who comes to my defense. And the same can be said. You know, people have, that same insanity has applied to the people who attack David Irving, Robert Farzan, and the revisionists who have been in this longer than I have. There is a sense of the other side declaring victory. Ha ha, we've won because no one's coming to their defense. Well, let people speak freely without going to prison, and then let's see where everyone stands. And the French government has done some very outlandish things. They have revoked, by governmental order, the French government revoked the PhD of a man named Henri Roque, who was a revisionist. They actually went back and took his PhD away, even though it had been awarded by the university he went to. In Germany, if you are accused of being a Holocaust revisionist, you're not allowed to plead, I'm right. You're not allowed to. If your lawyer takes the legal defense that my client is correct, the lawyer goes to prison. So in Germany, you're only given two choices. If you're accused of being a Holocaust revisionist, you can either plead, I'm insane, or you can plead, I'm guilty and I throw myself on the mercy of the court. That's the only two things you can plead. But you're not allowed to plead, no, I'm right, and hear my evidence. You're not allowed to. Again, this is absolutely insane. It goes against everything that is supposed to be enlightened.
Is there any... Can you think of any other topic where people who revise it are treated this way?
No, absolutely none. Absolutely none.
So you made probably the worst career choice for a historian ever. seriously, you couldn't have made a worse choice in terms of being a professional historian than questioning the Catholic Church during the Spanish Inquisition.
But you know, Vinny, considering my life choices, this is par for the course for me, my friend. I make bad choices. I mean, I was outed because I told my history to my girlfriend for 5 years, and it never even occurred to me that one day she would get angry and decide to out me. So I make bad choices. But yet, at the same time, to be a little less flippant about it.
Have you noticed that doing the right thing is often a bad choice with bad consequences?
And that's exactly what got me into it. When I got involved in it, it was the fact that people were getting thrown into prison or beaten up or attacked or in a couple of cases killed because of this. That's why I wanted to get into it. I'm not the kind of person who was raised to want to take the safe way around something. If there is something that gets my gut in an uproar, then I want to deal with it, especially as a Jewish person. I wanted a Jewish person in this fight on the right side of it. And the right side was, number one, saying everyone should be able to have their opinion without being beaten up or thrown in prison. And then the other point of it was, let's look at the evidence, which I did. I went to the camps, 6 different research trips to Auschwitz, several months at a time, each one. And I looked through the archives and I looked through the physical evidence. All I was ever being was honest about what I saw. But when I would speak on a talk show or in print, I would find myself being called the most abominable of names. And it took a toll on me. It took a toll on my family. But as I said earlier, I didn't mind taking the beatings. I took the beatings. It was only when I felt like I was actually about to be killed that I pulled back. Now, as a point of interest to your listeners, the Jewish Defense League leadership, who put the $25,000 bounty on my head in 97, they're dead now. They were arrested in December of 2001 in Los Angeles, where I live as well. They were arrested because they were planning on blowing up a couple of mosques in Los Angeles in retaliation for 9/11. In other words, their brilliant thinking was, let's kill a bunch of innocent people at worship in a mosque. Ooh, that'll deal a blow for justice. They were arrested before they could do it, and they were all – one of them – committed suicide in prison, and the other leader of the Jewish Defense League was killed. Those guys are not around anymore. The guys who put that bounty on my head are long dead, which is very ironic to me that I'm still here, and they are not. I don't take pleasure in the death of any human being, but there is a certain amount of irony there, maybe a little bit of schadenfreude that they did not survive, and I'm still here.
You're a sucker for punishment, aren't you? I love this this quote by, what was it? Have you ever seen the film Armageddon with Bruce Willis?
Of course, yeah.
Well, he finds out that his daughter's sleeping with one of the roughneck oil drillers or whatever, and she goes, "Daddy, I love him." And he goes, "She's the only one in your age bracket. He's the only one in your age bracket, Grace. It's not a choice. It's a lack of options." And I'm starting to think, Frank, that's how people like us have to live our lives now. It's not a choice. It's a lack of options.
Yeah. Well, definitely, because up until when I was outed, when I was David Stein, I had many options. I had film deals in the works. I was doing really well with my circle of Republican Party associates, and I was part of a group in L.A. called Friends of Abe, referring to Abe Lincoln. Friends of Abe is a secret private organization of Hollywood Republicans formed by Clint Eastwood, an actor named Gary Sinise, Kelsey Grammer. I'm not sure how familiar some of these names are in New Zealand, but I'm sure Clint Eastwood is very familiar.
Well, because I am Eastwood, yeah.
Yeah, I wondered about that when I first got your email, because that's a loaded name for me. I mean, now Clint Eastwood and I, we used to see each other every couple weeks, and I think he'd rather take a phone call from the devil himself than from me these days. that's how much these people disowned me. I was banned from that Clint Eastwood group. I was actually served with a formal notice of banning after I was outed. You may not come anywhere near us, even as a guest of another member. And I had worked with these guys for over 5 years, organizing their events and helping them out. And I was banned from every political organization in California, every Republican, GOP, conservative political organization. So, yes, lack of options. What the hell else? I had a book to write. And people who have said to me, "Well, Dave, why couldn't you have just slinked away?" And I said, because I was flat broke. I had a publisher willing to pay me to write a book. It was it's a good publishing company, and I'm not a half bad writer. That's not for me to say. It's for my readers to say. However, I don't think I'm a half bad writer, and I think that the book is entertaining, even if people don't agree with me. But yes, I did not have any other options beyond that.
And in terms of a career choice and what have you, how are you earning your money? I mean, and how are you earning your money now? How do you survive? I mean, I realize that you can't make money off of telling the truth, so I just beg for donations from people who listen to it.
Well, back when I was still working with the Republican Party and I was doing events, and I would be able to make a little bit of money off each event, not a lot, because politics is really more about giving money than making money. People who donate or give to a cause, it's really more about money going out the door than in the door. However, I was really good at what I did, and I was able to at least never lose money. And I'm always okay breaking even. If all I do is break even, then I'm a happy enough guy. But once I was outed, I made a joke to someone earlier this evening. We were talking about a young lady who I've been emailing, and I said, I'm really glad she's in Europe, because if she was in LA, I couldn't afford to take her to McDonald's right now. And, you know, your average young lady does not want to go on a date to McDonald's. And when a gentleman can't even afford that, that's pretty bad. But at the same time, I try to stay focused on what matters, and what matters to me right now isn't the money, isn't being able to afford this or that. What matters is I want people to know my story. I want to be able to defend myself in the book. I was able to support myself while writing the book because a real publishing company paid me. And I don't mean to slam people who self-publish, because that's one of the wonders of the internet age. It's very easy to self-publish a book, and that's great. It's wonderful that people can pay and get a book published. But I could not have done that because I didn't have $2 to spend towards publishing a book. But I found a publishing company, Feral House, located in the Pacific Northwest. Great publishing company, very supportive. And I was able to support myself for 8 months while writing the book because this wonderful publishing company believed in my story. Now, if nobody buys the book, they are going to be screwed. These wonderful people who paid me to write the book are really, really going to be screwed up the bum. So if you don't mind, I just want to say the name of the book is Republican Party Animal, singular, Republican Party Animal. And my website, for any of your listeners who want to check it out, is biginfidel.com. Biginfidel.com. Or you can just Google Republican Party Animal. The book is available at Amazon, Walmart, Barnes & Noble, Waterstones, and Foyles in the UK, and amazingly, Amazon.de, the German Amazon. I don't think they realize they're carrying it because my book is would be very illegal in Germany.
Now, let's get into specific details of studying into the Holocaust. What's real, what's not? Could you give us a background, like the whole story sort of in a nutshell, and then walk through it step by step? Because I understand that anybody listening, this might be a very controversial topic, but in my opinion, information is information devoid of emotion, and at least it should be, so that you can make a calm-headed decision.
Yes, absolutely. And to give you the best condensation of that I can, the things that are simply not in question. The Nazi government was very oppressive towards racial and ethnic minorities, Jews first and foremost, because they were the largest racial and ethnic minority in Germany at the time, but not just Jews. The Nazi government was a racial state. It was a racist state. It was a state that was based much as how the Soviet Union was based on class divisions. The Nazi government was based on racial divisions. Jews were absolutely segregated and treated very poorly based on their race, ethnicity, religion alone. And I use those three terms because Judaism can be any of those three things. It can be a race, it can be an ethnicity, it can be a religion. That's one of the things that makes Judaism very effective, is that it doesn't have to be one thing. I mean, if you say you're a Catholic, that denotes something specifically religious. Jews can be several things at once, or one of three things at once. So the Nazi government was very oppressive towards Jews. Jews were killed, especially in the early months of the invasion of Russia in summer of 1941. We know this because we have the documentation of Einsatzkommandos, Einsatzgroup leaders, who were sent to kill male Jews of a certain age in the territories being invaded. We know that happened. Now, where the story veers off is after 1941, we are told that the German government decided to issue a death warrant for every single Jew in East or West Europe, and that camps were set up in order to accomplish this task using an automated, technologically superior gas chamber and crematorium system. This is where the history gets real fuzzy, and this is where the facts stop agreeing with the standard story. Auschwitz is the camp that I studied the most, because Auschwitz is a camp where most of the evidence is still there, the archives and the physical evidence. And we're told that Auschwitz was the most efficient, deadly killing machine in mankind's history, a literal assembly line of murder. The facts simply don't bear that out. Now, that doesn't mean that bad things didn't go on at Auschwitz, because number one, Auschwitz was a civilian internment camp. It was a place where civilians, not soldiers, not enemy combatants, but civilians were sent simply because they were seen to be enemies of the state. Now, that's bad no matter what. And it's never a matter of defending what Auschwitz was as an entity. But we had civilian internment camps in the United States here for Japanese Americans and for Japanese non-citizens. A civilian internment camp is, in my opinion, always a bad thing. But the question is, at Auschwitz, were there these industrial assembly line gas chambers that polished off, depending on what statistics you listen to, 700,000, 1.1 million, 2.3 million, or 4 million people? And the facts simply don't support that. Now, as a caveat to your listeners, Rudolf Höss, not to be confused with Rudolf Hess, Hitler's, to put it in American terms, Hitler's vice president, but Rudolf Hess, the guy who parachuted into Scotland, I'm not talking about him, Rudolf Höss, with an umlaut, who was the commandant of Auschwitz, was not a good guy. And he was being investigated by the SS itself for killing inmates and taking their belongings for himself. I think that it was Rudolf Höss and his wrongdoing that really helped create a lot of this, a lot of the rumor and propaganda regarding Auschwitz. But Rudolf Höss was relieved from duty by the SS in 43. He was not a good fellow by any means, but we were already, by 1943, the Allies, the Western Allies, were intercepting the coded transmissions from Berlin to Auschwitz. We had broken the code. We could read what the coded secret transmissions were. And they had nothing to do with killing people, nothing to do with extermination. They basically had to do with Berlin asking the Auschwitz leadership, why is your output so low? We're sending you all these workers and you're not meeting your quota for a labor camp. What gives? Rudolf Höss was petrified that Berlin would find out about how bad he had let things get in the camp, especially regarding typhus and the epidemics that were going on. Auschwitz-Birkenau, which was the Jewish sector of Auschwitz, was built on a swamp. During the summer, the mosquito problem was outlandish. And Rudolf Höss, because of how corrupt he was, he let things get very much out of hand, and he was very petrified that Berlin would know how bad things had gotten. So I do want to say people died at Auschwitz. Some were killed, but primarily the disease epidemics, typhus mainly, dysentery also, and cholera, they were terrible. But what has happened is that was taken and turned into this myth of the assembly line gas chamber thing. The Soviet Union, which liberated Auschwitz in January of 44. They took an ordinary air raid shelter, the kind that you would find in almost any wartime structure like Auschwitz, and they turned it into a gas chamber. They remodeled it. They knocked down dividing walls. They took out the toilets and the sinks. And this was one of the first things that I got that really got me on the map, is I was able to get the museum director at the Auschwitz State Museum to admit to me that this was a reconstruction. It was a bomb shelter. And yet it's shown to about a million tourists a year. Well, that was the figures back in the 90s. Could be more now. I haven't even looked into that. But back in the 90s, at least a million tourists a year go through this phony building that's simply an air raid shelter. And they're told, this is the gas chamber. This is where they were gassed. And they take pictures and they take video. And it's vulgar because it's false. And the camp administration, the museum administration, they know that it's false. And they've known it's false from the beginning because it was not a secret what the Soviets did. They took an air raid shelter and they turned it into a for tourism purposes gas chamber.
Now, in terms of this, it was therefore the Soviets, not the Germans, who were exterminating the Jews like that? Or?
Well, no, what the Soviets did was they created the propaganda. The Soviets liberated all of the camps in Eastern Europe. The Americans and the British liberated camps in the West. So, for example, the Soviets liberated Auschwitz, and they liberated Majdanek. They liberated the barren ground where camps like Treblinka and Sobibor once stood. The Americans and the British liberated camps like Dachau, Mauthausen, Bergen-Belsen, that are all in Germany. None of these camps had gas chambers, but the Eastern Allies and the Western Allies all wanted them to. Because one of the things to remember about World War II that makes World War II such a fascinating war is that World War II was a war with an ex post facto reason for being. When World War II started, it began with the banner of keeping Poland independent. Germany invades Poland, the French and the British declare war on Germany. And Germany declares war on them back and kind of beats the hell out of them, chases the British back to the sea. So the whole war began under the banner of we need to keep Poland free and independent. Well, at the end of the war, the Western Allies pretty much handed Poland to Stalin. Well, that's a fine mess right there. 60, 70 million people are dead. Some of the greatest cities in the world burned to the ground. And it was all supposed to be in order to keep Poland free. And now we're handing Poland over to Stalin. If people had really thought about that and meditated on that for a few moments, it would have been mind-breaking for so many people because so many people around the world lost loved ones in World War II. So when you tell people the whole reason for the war is now being completely betrayed because we went to war to keep Poland from being a Nazi satellite, and now we're giving Poland to Stalin to be a Soviet satellite. So what was necessary in 1945 was a new reason for the war to have happened. And when the Allies came upon the camps and saw many ill, very sick, dying people in camps like Bergen-Belsen, people dying of typhus and dysentery and cholera, the Allies decided, well, now this is going to be the reason for the war. Here's why we fought. Look at these terrible, sick, horribly mutilated, dying people being gassed and burned. This is why we had to fight. Except that even among the most ardent of the Orthodox Holocaust scholars, no one claims the Holocaust began until the end of 1941, maybe slightly in the summer of 41, and then in earnest by the end. The war started in 39, 2 years earlier. The Holocaust is not the reason for the war. But if you ask the average kid teenager or even 30-year-old or 40-year-old these days, you say, why did we have to fight World War II? And they'll say, well, because of they were Holocausting the Jews. They were Holocausting people. Something that was not going on when the war began has now become the reason for the war. And that's why I say it was an ex post facto reason for being. It was necessary at the end of the war. The Soviets had to come up with a reason for the war beyond Poland because they were about to quite literally annex Poland. And the Western allies had to come up with a reason for the war beyond Poland because we were handing Poland to Stalin. So those horrible scenes of concentration camp inmates in 45, sick, skeletal, these people were not to blame for their condition, and it's terrible footage. But the Allies made those scenes the reason for the war, and everyone in the United States, my parents who were preteens at the time, they'd go to the movies and they would see these newsreels where the narrator would very breathlessly say, "This is why we went to war. Look at these poor people who are dying in skeletal because they've been gassed. They've been gassed and they were about to be burned, but our allies, our troops got there and saved them, and that's why we fought." So that's what makes World War II very interesting, is how there was there was one reason going in and then a separate reason coming out.
Well, it's kind of like, in military terms, you call it targets of opportunity. Like, if it just appears before you, yeah, let's attack then. Kind of like, this is an excuse of opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. When the, for example, would take the Bergen-Belsen camp. Bergen-Belsen was a camp that was liberated by the British in 45. Now, Bergen-Belsen, during the war, Bergen-Belsen was not a bad place to be. And I want to explain that because I don't want that to be taken out of context. During the war, Bergen-Belsen served as what was called a hostage camp. When the Germans would capture someone of importance to the other side, they would send them to Bergen-Belsen for safekeeping in order to try to barter them off for someone of importance to the German side. To give a specific example, when Stalin's son, Yakov Yugoshvili, when Stalin's son was captured by the Germans, Stalin's son was taken to Bergen-Belsen because Stalin's son was an important hostage who was to be kept healthy and fed in hopes of bartering him off for someone of importance to the Nazi leaders. So during the war, if you were at Bergen-Belsen, the camp, you would be assured that you'd be fed and you'd be cleaned and that you wouldn't be bombed by the Allies, because the Allies weren't about to bomb the camp where their loved ones might be held. So during the war, Bergen-Belsen was a very underpopulated camp where if you were sent there, you pretty much had a good chance of living. But at the very end of the war, the last couple of months of the war, when the Germans were trying to move their slave labor force into their interior, They were moving their slave laborers away from the east and away from the Eastern Front and into the interior of Germany. Here was Bergen-Belsen, a camp that was always underpopulated, which meant it had a lot of room, had a great deal of room. So they begin cramming their slave labor force into Bergen-Belsen, a camp that was maybe built to house 8,000 at most, was now having 80 or 90,000.
It sounds like they turned Bergen-Belsen into a Bergen-Schmergen.
Well, yeah, I think that's one way to put it, certainly. And it, needless to say, of course, it was a terrible tragedy for the people forced in there. But then another interesting thing happened. Once it was clear that the British were coming in close to Bergen-Belsen, the SS guards fled because the SS had done something rather silly from a point of view of not wanting to get killed if you lose a war. The SS had tattoos identifying them as SS, meaning that if the British or the Soviets or the Americans caught you and saw your tattoo, you were probably just going to get shot right there. So the SS who were guarding Bergen-Belsen didn't want to stick around and get shot by the British. So when the British entered Bergen-Belsen, the inmates had been running it for a couple of weeks because the SS had fled and the inmates were kind of running it. People would always ask me, well, why didn't the inmates just flee? Once the SS fled, why did the inmates stay there in the camp? And the answer to that is, well, number one, there really wasn't anywhere for them to run because all of Germany had been bombed back to the Stone Age. So as bad as Bergen-Belsen was, it wasn't like there was some paradise outside the gates. But more
it was like either a choice between a bombed out city with nothing, with nowhere to sleep, or a internment camp that still has a roof at least.
Yeah, exactly. And also, not only still has a roof, but whereas the Allies were bombing the cities, they were not bombing the camps. So if you were in Bergen-Belsen, at least you knew that you're not about to get blown up by a bomb. And it seemed like a better deal than trying to make your way in the cities that were getting bombed to flatland. So when the British entered Bergen-Belsen, they found the inmates pretty much running the show. The disease was terrible because all over Germany, everything that contributes to hygiene had been bombed. The fresh water lines, the railways, the sewers had been blown up. All of Germany was reduced to the worst possible conditions, and that was true in the camps as well as outside the camps. But the inmates stayed in the camps because they knew as long as they stayed in the camps, as long as the people in Bergen-Belsen stayed in Bergen-Belsen, they knew that once the Red Cross got there with the British Army, they would get relief. They would get care packages and food and the ability to emigrate, to sign up, to go to the West. It was a better deal than if they just tried to blend in among the German cities, because German citizens, especially in 1945 during the Morgenthau Plan, when the Truman administration at the time was looking to be as vengeful and cruel as possible to the German citizenry, it was a better deal to stay in the camp and be seen as a prisoner of conscience than it was to be seen as a German citizen. So all of these things led to the inmates of Bergen-Belsen staying there. That is not to excuse the slave labor mentality of the Nazi state. Of course, the British had that mentality, and the Americans all of the major powers, of course, the Japanese especially, they all had that mentality. None of it is excusable. But as a historian, the whole idea is you just try to explain what happened. And when the British went into Bergen-Belsen and saw these sick people, that became, all of a sudden, the reason for the war. And you have Trevor Howard, brilliant, famous British actor, and you have Alfred Hitchcock, both of them doing documentaries in 1945. And here we have the gas chambers at Bergen-Belsen where millions of people were snuffed out. And it's just complete phoniness. It's just war propaganda. There's nothing behind it. And on the American side, the same thing. We did the same thing at the Dachau camp, which had never been an extermination camp, that we hired American voice actors. Here we are at Dachau, where millions of people are gassed, and here's a gas chamber. It was pure propaganda for the masses at that time.
I mean, that would be almost as much just BS as saying the reason they call it duck hour is because the doorways were a little bit lower, so you had to duck out.
Yeah. I never thought of that. Thank you. That's actually a very interesting way to look at it. Because the American Army, the U.S. Army, took a very standard shower room, turned it into a gas chamber because a whole bunch of United States Congress people were going to come and tour it. And you can see those photographs online of senators, congressmen.
The soldiers wanted to gas all of those people, I wouldn't be, you know, opposed to it, but you know.
yes, it's a shame that the room didn't actually work as a gas chamber, because, yeah, I would probably say that for my Congress people and senators, yes, there would be no great loss. But it would, for the people back at home, for the people in New York and London and the various allied states, it was jarring to see this propaganda and to be told that these were gas chambers and that this was a planned program of extermination. Now, normally, within a couple of decades, this propaganda could be reversed. I mean, that there was Civil War, American Civil War propaganda. There's World War One propaganda. And typically, within a few decades, cooler heads prevail. But once the propaganda was initiated by the Allies, by the Soviets and the Western Allies, then the Jewish constituency took that ball and ran with it. And it became more important. One of the things that your listeners might want to know, the term Holocaust only became popularized in the 1970s, some 30 years later. No one used the term Holocaust. You can look at the Nuremberg transcripts. You can look at every transcript from the Nuremberg trial, the main Nuremberg trial, and then the minor trials, the smaller ones that happened years afterwards.
Did they used to call it solid cost and then they called it Holocaust when it realized it didn't hold water?
I'm just now getting used to your Kiwi humor right now, and I'm appreciating it very, very much.
Oh, no, this is just Vinny humor. The rest of the country doesn't think I'm funny, Brave.
Well, I do. I certainly think you're very funny, and I, as I said, I'm just now getting to appreciate the humor. And this is a kind of inversion of how things normally go. Normally, the propaganda is hot and heavy during the war, and then a couple decades go by, and people can revise it and speak rationally about it. But the Holocaust, totally different thing. The propaganda was hot and heavy enough during the war, and then after the war, every decade, it just got hotter and heavier. Until, number one, you get the term Holocaust is invented, is created, and then you get the laws in Germany and Canada and France first. Those were the first three, and then other countries after that. You get the laws that criminalize revisionism, and all of a sudden you're stuck with something that should have been revised so many decades ago. This whole thing could have been very gently revised back in the 70s. But by that point, it was too important to certain special interest groups, and they were going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that common sense would not prevail in this.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is why I call it platinum sense, because it's pretty frickin' rare.
Yeah, it's From my point of view, and knowing the people who I've known who have been punished for this, I'll give you one example for your listeners. There's a gentleman, his name is Germar Rudolph, G-E-R-M-A-R, Germar Rudolph. Now, Germar Rudolph was a doctoral candidate at the very prestigious Max Planck Institute in Stuttgart, one of the preeminent scientific institutions in the entire world. And Germán Rudolph was a young man in 1994, and he was asked by a revisionist who was on trial. Germán Rudolph was asked to conduct some chemical sample testing at Auschwitz in the supposed gas chamber rooms. Now, Germán Rudolph, he was a young man. He was married. He had a baby. He was a doctoral candidate. He was a brilliant young man with a bright future ahead of him. But he was asked to be a court-appointed witness and expert at a trial, and he agreed. He's not the man on trial. It was a revisionist who was on trial. The revisionist hired Rudolph to just do a chemical analysis. Nothing about opinion, just take some samples. Take some brick-and-mortar samples and run a chemical analysis. Germán Rudolph did this, and he was then prosecuted. He was prosecuted for simply being a court-appointed expert in another man's trial. It gets beyond Orwellian. I honestly don't think that Orwell or Huxley or any of those futurists could have imagined that you put a guy on trial and then he asks an expert witness to do a chemical analysis and the expert witness gets put on trial now. Germán Rudolph ended up being sentenced to a long prison term in Germany. He fled. He went first to Spain, then to the UK, then to Mexico, and eventually made his way to the United States. The United States ended up handing him over to German authorities, even though what Germán Rudolph did was not a crime here. In the United States, thank heavens, we cannot criminalize Holocaust revisionism. We can only rely on thuggish private groups like the Jewish Defense League to attack people, or groups like the ADL, groups like that, the Anti-Defamation League, to attack people.
I've still got a curious, maybe, who formed those organizations and what's their actual point? I mean, are they kind of like just... I don't know, the New York Mets or something, or if you're satanic, the New York Baphomets, they've got these things called cheerleaders and what have you, who just sit around and yell and dance and look pretty and what have you to distract everybody from the fact that there's copious quantities of advertising all over these people.
Well, each group is a little different. The Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, that's a very establishment, well-heeled organization. The Anti-Defamation League has been around for a long time. They get a lot of money. They like to present themselves as a respectable, quote-unquote, civil rights organization. They have no problem with bullying, harassing, and lobbying with their money to get their way. The Jewish Defense League was a slightly different animal. The Jewish Defense League was initially formed by a man named Rabbi Meir Kahana. Rabbi Kahana, to put his views in the easiest way to describe it, Rabbi Kahana was pretty much in favor of just kicking every Arab and Muslim out of any territory that Israel wanted to expand to. Rabbi Kahana really did not like Arabs and Muslims. He despised them. He was killed in the early 90s. He was shot in the head, and a guy named Irv Rubin took over the group. Irv Rubin had been Rabbi Kahana's protege over the decades. Irv Rubin was a glorified thug who enjoyed pipe bombs and punching people, including me. However, and this might maybe come across as a little odd to your listeners, Vinny, but in all the years that I dealt with Irv Rubin threatening me, beating me up, there was something honest about him because he never claimed to be more than a thug. I'm not in favor of thugs. I'm not in favor of hoodlums. and vigilantes and people who are violent. But at the same time, he never had pretenses. He was the kind of guy, he didn't like you, he'd break your nose. He didn't like you, he'd come and punch you. I think I'm a little easier with that than I am with the people who pretend to be something respectable, like the Anti-Defamation League, where they pretend to be some respectable civil rights organization, and they're not. I'd probably be happier with the thug. Maybe it's because I went to an inner-city Los Angeles high school that was primarily gang-controlled, you know, street gangs. Give me a thug. I can deal with that. It's the pretentious people, the ones who are thugs at heart but claim to be something better. Those are the people I have more of a problem with.
Yeah. It reminds me of the Sound of Music. You know, you were 16 going on 17, but it's more like you're just a wussy piece of crap who can't even be bothered knowing who it is you are and what reality is because you're too afraid that it will destroy your entire life. And trust me, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know an iota of what reality currently is and you want to find out, it will destroy your life. There's no ifs, buts, or maybes about it. Oh, here's everything I spent my entire life trying to understand, and now it's fracked.
Yeah.
You know, that's basically the decision, and why so few people actually really want to listen to this kind of thing, because it's inherently traumatic in and of itself to let go of things. So when people hear reality and it doesn't compute, it doesn't line up with their perception of reality, they'll have a grieving process. One of the stages of grieving is anger, like beating somebody up for no reason.
Definitely. Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's been hard for me because I lost many friends in the early 90s, and then a year ago when I was outed, my gosh, I lost a lot of friends. Of course, I don't think they were ever really truly friends because of how they abandoned me, but they did not want to listen. And what made it frustrating for me is these were people, some of the political friends I had, these were people who trusted me and knew me to be a sane, rational individual. These were people who published my work on their blogs, on their websites, in their newspapers, and they knew me to be a man who is not prone to going off the deep end and saying crazy things. So when I was outed and when everyone got to know that I was David Cole instead of David Stein, the percentage of my friends who said, well, you seem to be a smart guy, let me at least listen to your point of view, that's like 2%. 98% didn't want to hear it, didn't want to even entertain that I might have been speaking the truth.
Do you know what percentage of the U.S. population fought against the British and beat them?
No, I don't know the number.
2%.
Really? Interesting. I did not know that. That's very interesting, Vinny. I didn't know that.
It shows how many people are actually prone to, A1, have revolutionary thought, and B2, actually act on it.
Yeah. That's a very, very, very good point. That really is. Because the majority of the people who I was friends with up until a year ago, they just marched in lockstep with the path of least resistance. And I was given the option of recanting. I was given the option by the Republican Party of just recanting my views on Auschwitz and the Holocaust and the gas chamber. And they were like, well, you won't be the guy that you were, that you can salvage some of it. And that's a choice that's not a choice. I'm not going to do that. I'm not about to lie and say things I know aren't true in order to salvage a little bit of friendship and approval by people who obviously weren't even my friends to begin with. So I just couldn't. I couldn't recant. That's why I decided to write the book and be as balls out as possible in terms of explaining what I was always saying for the last 22 years.
Yeah. See, me, I only think it's justifiable to lie to liars like cops and politicians, for example.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree with your policy on cannabis, officer. And no, I'm not smoking a joint. This is a cigarette.
When you're in a corrupt system, you lose respect for it. And it's very difficult to respect the people who are the officials in a corrupt system.
And it's even harder when they've got no respect for you or the truth.
Yeah, yeah. So I just decided at that point a year ago that to hell with it. I'm going to write a book and be completely honest and out there about everything. One of the things, to go back to something I already said about how wonderful my publisher is, but one of the things that I loved about my publisher is that they did not put any limit on how revisionist my book can be. In other words, they didn't say, oh, don't say that. That's going too far. I was given absolutely no limits. When people read my book, that's my thoughts, with no censorship and a little bit of cussing. There are a few four-letter words in the book, but that's kind of who I am. And so it's a very honest, straightforward book.
Well, David, I was meant to take several breaks and what have you, but you just keep going, which is good.
Yeah, I'm a little verbose. I'm certainly not the
kind of
person. Could
you define the word verbose specifically for me?
Garrulous, talkative, and not knowing when the hell to just shut the hell up.
You know, there's something to be said for that, though, because technically, this is talk radio, and that's kind of what you're supposed to do.
I'm one of those guys who has never had a problem with public speaking. I love it. I love being able to just talk in a public setting. It's fun for me, and I did it as a revisionist, and then I did it during my political years. It's something that I really do enjoy.
Hey, and now with the internet, you could probably start your own radio show, bro. It'd be great. You could rant, talk over the guests. It'd be fantastic.
Oh, I'm doing video blogs, which is funny to me because my ex-girlfriend used to do video blogs, and I always thought that was the kind of thing that like young girls do when they want to show makeup tips. And now all of a sudden I'm doing video blogs explaining various things and showing video clips to support my work. I feel young again because I'm 45. And I've never quite felt my age, but I'm not sure if it's a good thing. I think I'm not sure how much of my voice people can take. I have a very unique voice, and to me it's kind of an annoying voice. So I hope your listeners were not overly annoyed by having to listen to me for this long.
Ah, don't worry, man. There's plenty of irritating voices out there, and you know, you're actually probably on the lower end of the scale. I've heard worse.
But, you know, you've got that great New Zealand accent, which I kind of rank up alongside of the Irish accent. It's great accents that people love. Me, I kind of sound a little bit like a rock quarry crumbling, you know, like just a bunch of gravelly bits of dirt falling on themselves. I don't necessarily think I have a good voice. However, if people do go to my website, biginfidel.com, they will see a link to my YouTube video logs where they will not only get a chance to hear me being verbose and garrulous, but they can see me as well, which is just icing on the cake because it's even worse to have to see me along with having to hear me.
You know, I think you just spared a whole lot of people a lot of heartbreak.
I just hope that the book that I've written will speak for me because I did put a great deal of effort into it. And I really do think that it can go a long way towards bringing some common sense to this issue and the way that the Holocaust has been abused politically Holocaust history, how it's been hijacked politically, how stuff's been invented for political reasons. If I can, in my own little way, now that I've been thrown back into this, and I'm older, a bit wiser, still just as talkative and annoying, but older and wiser, if in my own little way, if I can bring a little bit back of common sense to the field, I really hope that it'll all be worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, like I always say, ladies and gentlemen, the best thing you can do is just not nothing. You know, that's what we get. How can I contribute? How can I do this? Well, sitting there just talking about how you can do it as a start, but you actually got to start doing something, anything. Just don't do nothing.
Very well put, my friend. Very well put. I would agree with that 100%.
David Stein, ladies and gentlemen, you can check out his website. Again, that is biginfidel.com. Biginfidel.com. Not to be confused with the MILF porno website, biginfidelity.com.
I should have gotten that domain name when I could. That would have been even better.
Yeah, you might have had some increased traffic there. With erections. Now, thank you very much. We will see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Please remember, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so if you can, please do go to the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. Thank you very much. We'll see you again.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.